Welcome to the Latter Gay Stories Podcast, the show that features real people, real stories, and real talk. This is the intersection of sexuality and reality. Now, here's the voice of the show, Kyle Ashworth.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Latter Gay Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Ashworth. An exciting episode that we have prepared for you today, as we, as you are well aware, as we put together the Latter Gay Stories episodes, discuss important topics that relate typically to people who identify directly through or on the LGBT spectrum. But today's podcast episode is going to be a little bit different. We are welcoming to the podcast Greg Prince. Greg is the author of the new book that recently was released, Gay Rights in the Mormon Church. We'll discuss with Greg why he wrote the book, the implications of the book, and how that directly impacts the individual lives of those who are on or impacted through topics of LGBT nature, but also general membership within Mormonism as a whole. We are really excited to have Greg here on the podcast. I want to welcome you to the podcast, Greg.
Thank you.
And thank you for giving us a few minutes of your time in an obviously busy schedule, especially as you release books, but for giving us an opportunity to pick your brain a little bit and talk about a discussion, a topic that means a lot to all of us.
Let's go for it.
Maybe the first place to start in the discussion is, why gay rights? You are an author of a wide variety of topics, mostly centered around Mormonism's people. David O. McKay, Leonard Arrington, so specific persons. The gay rights in the Mormon Church is a topic that is far more encompassing than your other writings.
In a way, all four of my books have found me. The first one was on early priesthood, and that came out of being an elder quorum president for 4 years and seeing a lot of questions but very few answers. So eventually I decided that if I was going to get answers, I might as well share them, and spent 8 years tracking that one down and writing it. That one led immediately to the second, because the mission president in the D.C. North Mission, Bob Wright, saw what I was doing on the priesthood book and said that his aunt was Claire Middlemas, the private secretary to President McKay for 35 years. He had inherited her papers and wanted my assistance in writing the McKay biography. Right after the McKay biography was published, I was giving a talk in Logan, and afterwards, a woman came up, introduced herself. She said, "I'm Susan Arrington Madsen. Can we talk?" So the McKay book found me because of the priesthood book. The Arrington book found me because of the McKay book. The gay rights book had a different genesis, but it came knocking as well. The first event that led to the writing of it came shortly after the Prop 8 election in 2008. I wasn't aware when this happened that the end game on this would be to write a book. Helen Whitney is a PBS producer. She did the four-hour documentary entitled The Mormons that was broadcast on PBS in 2007. I got to know her because of my work on the McKay book, worked behind the scenes for a couple of years with her, did a little bit of work in front of the camera. In the aftermath of the Prop 8 election, just a week later, she called and said, "My best friend, Andrew Solomon, who writes for The New Yorker, has basically turned on me because of the Mormon Church's role in Prop 8 and because I did a documentary that had anything nice to say about what he termed this evil religion." Mm. She said, "Can you help me to repair the friendship?" That was a process that took about 2 years. Initially through email exchanges, eventually I went up to New York, had lunch with him. We got along pretty well, and I said, "Help me to be part of the solution and not the problem." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Write an article for Dialogue." He said, "I'll do that," but he was so involved in what turned out to be a huge and hugely successful book called Far From the Tree that he didn't have the time to sit down and write for me. So I said, how about we do an interview and we publish that? Let's do it. We did it. It was published in Dialogue. It's a very good interview. But that really turned out to be my initial sensitization to the nuance of LGBT issues, particularly as they relate to the Mormon Church. Not long after that, I was asked to be on an advisory board at Johns Hopkins University in their School of Education, even though I'm not an educator by profession. And the first meeting that I attended, a gentleman was sitting next to me who worked in the film industry in L.A. I said, I'm going to be out there next week speaking at a symposium. Should we get together for lunch? At lunch, he found out that I was LDS. This was a year and a half or so after the Prop 8 election. And he said, you sound reasonable on this issue. That was surprising to him.
Because everything else he's heard.
That's right.
Was not reasonable.
He said, would you be willing to meet with one of my dear friends who is a gay activist? Sure. So a couple nights later, the three of us had dinner, and Rick Jacobs, his friend, said the same thing at the end of the conversation. You're reasonable about these issues. That began a lasting friendship with Rick. Rick was the founder of the Courage Campaign, which initially was a multifaceted political activism organization in California working on a variety of issues, but Rick is gay, and when Prop 8 hit, that galvanized that organization, and they became really the face of the opposition to Prop 8. In the eyes of some people in Salt Lake, Rick Jacobs was public enemy number one. But I found him to be a delightful person. He remains a dear friend, as is Andrew Solomon. There were other people that I met subsequently, some of them quite high profile in the national LGBT scene, and it just gradually began to dawn on me that this was a topic much like early Mormon priesthood that just had not been treated in depth. Another key event was when Randall Thacker became the president of Affirmation. He lived in D.C. He came out one evening to my house, just called me cold. I didn't even know who he was at that point, and said, can I come out and visit with you? Sure. He talked about wanting to run for the presidency of Affirmation. He said, this is what I want to do. He said, in the past, for 30 years, Affirmation has been essentially a group of old LDS gay men who are yelling at the church. He said, I want to change that.
What was the pitch that Randall gave you? What was intriguing about that?
That he wanted to build bridges. When he won the election, he came back to me and said, would you serve on the board of directors? And I said, if you do what we talked about, yes, I'll be happy to. And I spent, I think, 3 or 4 years on the board. But being on the board was the next step in my education, that having that interaction at a fairly intimate level with all of these amazing people opened my eyes not only to who and what they were, but what they had gone through and continued to go through as being people who were trying in most instances to maintain their church membership, but with difficulty.
Which seemed to have a great parallel to the priesthood topic.
Yes. So eventually it just weighed on me that this needed to be done. I didn't see anything else out there that was treating it. Now, initially, I thought that a book on Prop 8 and the Mormon Church is what was needed. Once I got into it, I saw, no, you can't look at Prop 8 in isolation. You have to look at Prop 22 prior to that. And if you're looking at Prop 22, then you go back to Hawaii and look at that, and pretty soon you realize you've got to have a more logical starting point, and that starting point is in the late 1960s, that the Mormon Church and American society were sensitized to this issue almost simultaneously, but through different avenues. 1968 was the first time that homosexual as an adjective appeared in the General Handbook of Instructions. No mention of anything prior to that. 1969 was the Stonewall Riots. 1969 was also Spencer Kimball's publication of The Miracle of Forgiveness.
That's right. Crime Against Nature.
Which was neither miraculous nor about forgiving.
The irony.
Yes.
Why is it that you believe, why do you think that the impetus or the focus on the LGBT topics or even the mention of homosexuality was silent? We have vague references as early as 1897 of George Q. Cannon, October General Conference, but not much, if anything at all the way up into handbook time.
But this just mirrored what was going on in American society.
So you're correlating that with historical events.
Sure.
There was not enough of an uprising within the church, not enough of a contagion or problem that had developed at that point to even address it?
I think so. It was just not enough of an issue that it got on anybody's public radar screen. There were some private discussions about it, but generally it was an atmosphere of live and let live. That yes, gays were largely self-closeted, but that seemed to be a status quo that was satisfying to most groups. It wasn't just, but that was the status quo. And then in the late 60s, with Stonewall, it became a national issue and remained that to the current day. So once I started to look at the antecedents of Prop 8, then I could see that you could start the narrative in the late 1960s and it made sense. That's when it became a public issue within the church. So the book tracks from then up to the present day, but it does it topically as had the two biographies that I did. I think that's a much better way of approaching it because all of these threads tend to be moving forward, but not necessarily in parallel. And if you're trying to jump from one to the other and march forward chronologically, it becomes a mess.
Do you think, so this is just something as you brought that up about the timeline, Handbook of Instructions, 1968, Stonewall Riots in 1969. Do you think this fueled the church in a way? And I'm asking you to jump back into your research a little and maybe speculate as to whether or not the church felt emboldened by a year earlier this was on their radar and they were already talking about it.
No.
And then 69 happens,
no.
Stonewall Riots, and they say, hey, this is
No,
evidence.
I looked very carefully through the McKay diaries his diaries went up through his death in 1970, and there was never a big issue about this. There's never even a mention of the H word being in the New General Handbook in 1968.
But clearly an issue because apostles like Packer were involved in reviewing sexual abuse cases and homosexuality
Packer,
cases.
Packer not so much then. It had been the portfolio of Spencer Kimball going back into the 1940s. And then later they added Mark Peterson to that because of the volume. And it wasn't just LGBT issues, it was sexual transgressions in general, most of which would have been heterosexual.
Correct. Yeah.
But that was their domain for a couple of decades. I feel sorry for the men to have to deal with a nonstop diet of that kind of stuff. That would tend to jade anybody. And I think it did them as well. I think it colored their worldview and probably helped Spencer Kimball to be more homophobic than he might have been otherwise, simply because he had to deal with the messiest of the cases, heterosexual and homosexual.
So he was able to see a lot. And then it probably
absolutely
maybe increased his desire to persecute and prosecute.
Yeah, speculation, but it's consistent with what we saw. Yeah.
As we begin going through your book, it isn't necessarily in chronological order in
no.
orders of events. You've taken each chapter and highlighted a critical point that influenced the LDS Church's response to this topic. So it's probably not the best to do the interview in terms of chronology. But maybe we start by trying to understand doctrine and policy in terms of change within the church.
When you use those two words, doctrine and policy, realize that it comes down to semantics and what is in the mind of the user. One person's doctrine is another person's policy. The one exception that I saw was with David O. McKay, where he was very careful in his choice of words. He never used the word doctrine when he referred to blacks and priesthood. He always called it a policy, and on private occasions would occasionally say, this is a policy that will change. So you have to be careful not to put too much weight in those two words, because they mean different things to different people at different times.
And I fully concede that. The interesting part is you get a Dallin Oaks in an AP interview who says there is no difference between policy and doctrine, because in a church that believes in modern revelation, the two negate each other. We just believe in revelation. So there shouldn't be this distinction. He says, I don't know that it's possible to distinguish between policy and doctrine in a church that believes in continuing revelation and sustains its leader as a prophet. So under that light, he says, whether we call it policy or doctrine, it doesn't matter. It came from the mantle.
Yes, but even with that being said, we still hold special deference for our canon, for our standard works, that those rise generally above the level of current discussion, even at the house levels of the church.
Especially in terms of sustaining that as scripture.
Yes.
And doctrine.
Yeah. But the root of the word doctrine is teaching. It doesn't mean immutability, although some people will give it that connotation. In its purest form, it just is whatever we're teaching now, that is doctrine.
So in terms of the latter, the more restrictor, the doctrine that has more restriction or clout, does doctrine change in the church?
I've not seen a single significant doctrine within Mormonism that has gone unchanged since the beginning of the church.
When the general consensus of law-abiding Mormons will argue that doctrine does not change.
We sit down and have that discussion, and I'll show them. If they want to bring up a particular doctrine, we can look at it historically, and I think their eyes will be opened. So, even something as fundamental and you would think unchanging as the nature of deity, in fact, changed radically during the first decade of the church's existence.
Yes, and I'll concede with that. I believe we're on the same page, because I believe both doctrine and policy, there's evidence, ample evidence of change. As we can venture down polygamy, blacks in the priesthood, the word of wisdom, tithing. There are many grand policies and doctrines that are bound to change and have changed.
Yes, I view the two terms as largely synonymous with each other, but certainly you will find church members who will say, well, no, when you say doctrine, it's unchangeable. When you say policy, it might be changeable. That just doesn't hold up historically.
Do they say that in defense of an ever-changing church, or do they say that in defense of them trying to justify the gray areas of
the very nature of organized religion is that people would like to hold on to something that is constant, because this is a scary and changing world. And if they view religion as constancy amid change, which a lot of people do, that's very comforting to them, and that's fine, more power to them. But it turns out that it's not quite as fixed in stone as they would think, and that's where they get uncomfortable, and they realize that if you look historically with a very critical eye, you see that not just within the LDS tradition, but within organized religion in general, Christian, Judaic, whatever, it's evolutionary.
So we deal with a Packer, a Kimball. In today's day, we have Oaks. Let's talk a little bit about archaic and draconian teachings and tradition, and how this understanding of tradition has maybe influenced the direction the church has taken on this particular topic.
Okay, where do you want to start?
What timeline shall we begin?
Well, if you look not just at American society, but really at world society, until the late 19th century, nobody really cared. Homosexuality was just a different variety of norm. And then in the late 19th century, the Germans coined the word homosexual, and that started to move us in a different and darker direction. Gradually, the medical community and then the legal community and the religious community all arrived at a consensus that this was not only a sin but a crime, and one that threatened society and therefore had to be blotted out. Those were really the dark ages in society in general, and that was the status quo really up through the middle of the 20th century. And I think it was a reaction to that that finally caused the Stonewall riots to start to change the course of history. But the paradigm in those dark decades was that not only is this sinful, evil, and a threat to society and something that had to be stamped out, but it was entirely present because of people having made poor choices, and that they should be able to make good choices and quit being gay because that's just a chosen lifestyle rather than a biological imprint. And that's where everybody was for decades. That's where the medical community was. That's why the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders classified homosexuality as a disorder, as a disease. In 1973, they reversed ground on that, but those were some dark years when they were still calling this a disease. And I think still, in the minds of many clinicians, medical and psychological, there's still that overlay that this is pathological. We've got to get past that.
And Will, I want to jump into genetics, because you have a great section in the book about genetics as to causation of sexuality. So if you're painting the picture that this wasn't that big of a deal prior to the 60s, what was the cause of it now jumping on the radar so quickly? We know the 80s brought on the AIDS scare, so there were plenty of lots of attention that was brought into this topic. But in the 20 years prior to that, what started people's engines, motors running, to say, this is something we should now fight against, push back against, and especially within Mormonism?
Well, it was a seesaw. In 1960, every state in the United States had criminalized homosexual behavior. That started to reverse itself a year later, with one state saying, no, this isn't going to be criminalized anymore. But it was a back and forth thing. Into the late 60s, you had Stonewall. In the 70s, you know, the 70s were a time of kind of free-for-all on social issues anyway. You're right, the AIDS epidemic changed the game for everybody. And initially, it was a very dark time for gays because they were disproportionately stricken with AIDS. It's an accident that it came into this country through the gay male population. It could just as easily have come in through the straight population. And in Africa, it was primarily a straight disease. But in the U.S., it was a gay disease, and that put a big stigma on it. But this also had an enormously beneficial reaction on the part of the gay community, that the way that community coalesced and dealt with the epidemic was so noble that I think it started to change a lot of stereotypes in the straight population, which realized, hey, these are rather magnificent people, and look at how they are dealing with this enormous medical onslaught, and attitudes started to change.
For the better.
Yes. In most quarters, but there are still people in our society who will talk about the gay disease. They're not people that I spend a lot of time dealing with, but there is a segment in our society that I don't think will ever get past the point of stigmatizing homosexuality. In their mind, this is a fixed thing, and they're not about to change.
I want to talk, and we brought this up earlier in the podcast, but I want to focus a little bit of time on a personal venture of mine in trying to understand this topic among active, believing Latter-day Saints. As I've spent so much time with stake presidents and bishops and auxiliary leaders regarding this topic who want to better understand this topic, the constant message that I get from them is a feeling that this is the way I was taught, and I want to either unteach myself or learn about this topic better. So I see this element of tradition that creeps in, that the old guard or those, and we'll bring them up frequently in this podcast, but the Kimballs, the Packers, the Oaks, the Marky Petersons, the Bruce R. McConkies, who taught a very rigid view regarding this topic, those lessons still exist, though Miracle of Forgiveness is out of print, Letter to a Friend is gone, most of Harmon Rector's talk was eliminated from the church periodicals, so much of the language is gone, yet the tradition and the rhetoric exists. Is that a real thing? Is that something that I see? And
it does persist. There are two threads that tend to pervade institutional religion, beyond Mormonism, but inclusive of it. One is conservatism. The nature of institutional religion is to conserve the past. That's what conservatism is. And so, by nature, institutional religion tends to be resistant to change, just generically. And a lot of people want to go to church on Sunday to be reassured that nothing is going to change. When change happens, they can easily get discombobulated. The other thread is religious fundamentalism. This really began in the early years of the 20th century as a response to what was called higher criticism of the Bible. It was when German scholars first started to appropriate the tools of science to look at the Bible in its context, historically, religiously, and take it in very different directions than previous scholars had done. This was a huge existential threat to many conservative religions, and Mormonism was among those. That was when we stepped into that arena in the person of Joseph F. Smith, who was the church president and, in my view, was the first Mormon fundamentalist. He started the genre of Mormon fundamentalism that was then perpetuated by his son, Joseph Fielding Smith, and by his grandson-in-law, Bruce McConkie. That became the predominant doctrinal theme through most of the 20th century. I think we're finally backing away from that, and there has not been any successor to Bruce McConkie to carry on that tradition. But if you look at those two things, conservatism on the one point and fundamentalism, that is what still allows so many people in the church to cling to these stereotypes of the past.
That are outdated, archaic, draconian.
And harmful.
And harmful.
Yes.
On one hand, we have a current apostle who says that we aren't entitled to believe science, that we are to embrace spiritual experiences over the learned, yet science is used in other aspects of promoting messages of the church. I guess my point in this is the church has evolved from a point where they were strictly punishing people who were just gay, not acting on it.
Yes.
The term homosexual enough was grounds for discipline, to the point where today the doctrine has changed or the policy has changed to include only acts of homosexuality.
Well, that's where we started. In the late 60s, when it first came into the general handbook, the proscription was against homosexual acts. When Kimball became president, it took a dark turn. That's when being homosexual was the sin, and a sin that could merit excommunication. After Kimball's death, we went back to the McKay-era policy that it then became homosexual acts, and that's still pretty much where we are now. And I think the most encouraging thing that happened in the intervening years was, okay, you can be gay, you can even be openly gay, and we won't slam you unless you act out on that. Now, that's a difficult position to maintain, but nonetheless, what it meant on a practical level was that gay men and women could serve full-time proselytizing missions, and many have done that. Unthinkable during the Kimball years. So there has been some movement in the right direction, even though it hasn't been a straight line, constant movement. And certainly the policy in 2015 was a big step backwards.
Generally, and we'll get to the November 2015 policy, generally, do you believe the membership of the church is understanding that translation, understanding that that language has changed from homosexuals to homosexual acts? Or is that orthodoxy still exist where the blinders are still on?
A couple of years ago, I spoke with a gentleman who'd had a lot of contact with ecclesiastical leaders in preparing the essays that are now on the church website, Gospel Topics essays. He said they had done a survey within the United States, and they found that 20% of the American Mormons knew that the essays existed, and 4% had read them. So my response to your question is, most people in this church are clueless as to what this church really is. And they probably don't care, and they certainly will start to get agitated if you decide that you want to try to educate them. They're more comfortable in their own status quo, which is, don't bother me with the data.
This episode is probably not for them.
I would agree.
You're not going to sell many books, too.
I don't worry about selling books. I never have worried about selling books. Two of my four books, I didn't even take royalties because I felt that it was more important to have a lower price and make them more available. So my hope is that even a few people will either be emboldened by learning the history because that's where they already were, but they didn't have the data on their side or know that they had the data on their side. And then maybe it'll change a few minds beyond that. If that happens, that's a victory. That's worth all of the effort put in. In the case of this book, as opposed to my other three books, it has the potential of saving lives. None of my other three did that. So this becomes by far the more important.
Let's discuss causation. So we cover a little territory about tradition, which I believe a lot of well-meaning, not to disrupt this idea of what a typical Mormon looks like, but I believe most members of the church are influenced by tradition, and they just have not yet got to the point where they know better, to understand better. Mm-hmm. And I think podcast episodes like this, books like your writing and advocacy that the LGBT community is pushing, not fierce and evil advocacy, but just here am I, understand and hear my story, get to know me better. Those grassroots efforts are changing perceptions within the church. The next step that we usually get to is then the question of causation. Nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. Biology, is there a gay gene? Are people born this way? Is this something we just create because we woke up one morning and thought, society loves homosexuals, let's be one? Or I think being trans is an incredible idea because it's so well accepted, I should just try it. Which seems to be this idea that we chose this spectrum. So let's discuss a little bit about causation through your research and what you've written in the book. What causes homosexuality?
You're much more plugged into the gay community than I am. How many people do you know who chose to be gay?
I've yet to find one.
There you go.
And I keep asking the question.
Yep. But sometime in the past, somebody decided and a consensus evolved that this was a chosen lifestyle, a chosen behavior, chosen orientation. And nobody challenged that successfully, largely because it's not that the science was arguing against that, it's that there was no science yet. And so the behaviorists were able to rule the roost because there were no data that argued against that. Gradually, the data started to come in. Now, in the 80s, maybe. Dean Hamer at NIH was one of the pioneers in molecular biology and was looking for the gay gene. There was a lot of enthusiasm, I think, on the part of the LGBT community that there would be such a gene identified, because that at least would move them from, I chose this lifestyle, to, no, I was born this way. Well, it turned out that there isn't a gay gene, but that's not surprising if you look at non-heterosexuality, which more is becoming the term, because there are so many flavors that it's not necessarily even homosexuality. There are other things that are apart from the norm of straight.
Asexuality.
Yes.
For example. Bisexuality.
Or
bi.
Or pan.
Correct.
Yes. Or intersex.
And even looking at Kinsey's research, you have six different versions of that sexuality on a straight line.
But yeah. that only deals with sexual orientation and not with gender identity.
Correct.
You put those two together, you've got a grid now, and the combinations start to multiply. I don't think anybody knows yet how many different flavors of non-heterosexuality exist. But they are different entities. It's not a linear scale that's quantitative, that if you got 82% this instead of 85%, you're going to present differently. It doesn't work that way. So Kinsey, on the one hand, helped by starting to impose some order on the field, but he hurt by saying that this is a linear thing. It way oversimplified it. And I think that's done more damage than good in the ensuing years. I think what you have to understand is this is this many flavors and more. And each one of them is going to have its unique biological imprint. So there's not going to be a single hypothesis that explains everything. Now, for example, in twin studies, we know that there is a higher coincidence of homosexuality amongst identical twins than in fraternal twins.
So the coincidence is that both
that
identify as gay.
Somewhere between 50 and 60% of the time, if one identical twin is gay, the other one will be gay. But it drops to under 20% if they are fraternal twins.
And so to explain fraternal, were separate sacs, separate eggs that were fertilized.
Right.
So not the split.
Right. So in the one case, you've got genetic identicality, genetically identical. On the other, the amount of shared genetic material can go from nearly 100% all the way down to under 50%. Well, it's 50 to 60% coincidence here, it's under 20% here. That tells you two things simultaneously. Number one, it says there is a genetic component to this. Otherwise, those two numbers would be the same. The other is there is an epigenetic, above genetics, other factors that can control how the genes are expressed that weighs in on this. Otherwise, this number would be 100%. So it's part genetics, it's part epigenetics, depending on the flavor of non-heterosexuality that you're talking about. There is a well-known, long-standing phenomenon that generally is called the birth order effect, that with a single biological mother, the likelihood that subsequent male births will be gay increases by 33% with each successive birth. Now, if the possibility of the first son being gay is 5%, then the next one, it's 5% plus 1/3 of 5%. So it doesn't go up real fast, but if you get very large families, 7 or 8 boys, then you're approaching a 50-50 probability that those later sons are going to be gay. They are much more likely than their oldest brothers. It's interesting, though, that it doesn't involve female births, and it doesn't get changed if there are females born in the succession.
Within the succession, yeah.
And it doesn't involve left-handed offspring of males. But it's a very well-established phenomenon, probably having to do with interaction between the male fetus and the maternal immune system. at a level that we really don't understand yet. But there's the additive effect because the mother is continually presented with subsequent pregnancies with the same immunological stimulus that she saw the first time around, but it builds on itself. It's like a booster shot if you're being immunized, that with each successive booster shot, your level of immunity increases. That's just one flavor. There's what's called epigenetic canalization. This has to do with the balance between the absolute testosterone levels in the developing fetus, which generally are higher with the male fetus and lower with the female, but those can be reversed, and the receptors for testosterone in the brain, that generally there are more receptors in a male fetus and fewer in a female, but those can be reversed as well, so that you can have masculinization of a female fetal brain because of testosterone and testosterone receptors being overly expressed compared to normal female fetuses. Those are just a couple of examples of it. There are a lot more, and we haven't done much more than begin to decipher the biology of those. But what is very clear is that sexual orientation and gender identity are imprints deep in the fetal brain, that the sex organ is the brain. That determines sexuality, and that those imprints not only are biological, but they're deep and they're permanent, and you can't change them.
That really hurts Christianity, because the message
is... It shouldn't hurt Christianity if they read their Bible correctly. Christianity has done itself a disservice by making up its mind in advance and then marshaling biblical scriptures, twisting them, and saying, this justifies our homophobia.
That's probably a great segue into that topic. In terms of Mormonism, let's discuss the scriptures in modern-day canon that exclusively go through the topic of homosexuality.
All right, we just did it.
Let's start with the Book of Mormon.
None.
Doctrine and Covenants.
None.
Pearl of Great Price.
None. There you go.
So the Bible has a few. Sometimes we call them clobber scriptures.
Mm-hmm. If you look at those in their context, then you come up with a different answer than you thought you knew originally. I wound up being a minor co-author with a Methodist minister of a book that was published just a couple of months before mine, where he is chronicling his conversion as a Methodist minister from somebody who condemned homosexuality to where he no longer views it as sinful, and he walks through that study of those Old and New Testament scriptures and convincingly, in my mind, shows that now these are not saying what homophobic people now are saying who want to justify their homophobia. That there are things that those scriptures are condemning, but it's not the state of homosexuality. It has to deal with sexual violence, with pederasty. This is men imposing themselves on young boys. It has to do with slave owners imposing sex on their male slaves. It has to do with temple prostitution, both heterosexual and homosexual. And if you read those scriptures with a guide that says, here's the context, then you realize that he's actually getting you through those to a different place where you say, yeah, it wasn't gay, it was violence, it was imposition of will, it was prostitution. Those were the sins.
What was the great message of Sodom and Gomorrah then?
Was inhospitability towards visitors.
But everything I've been taught is about homosexuality.
Go back and reread them in this context.
Is there a reason why within LDS theology, in terms of homosexuality, Romans, Leviticus, these scriptures are not being used?
What organized religion tends to do is to use scripture defensively. Meaning, we choose what we want to teach in a religion. It doesn't matter which one it is. and then we cherry-pick the scriptures to justify that. Rather than using the scriptures normatively, which is to say, read deeply, see what the context is, see what the will of God is that permeates the text, and say, this should inform what we should be. Instead, we do the reverse, and we either decide to be what we are, or we have evolved to be what we are, then we reach into the scriptures and cherry-pick to justify where we are. That doesn't work very well, but almost every religious tradition I'm aware of has played the same game. This is why you have so many different types of religions, all claiming the Bible as their ultimate authority, and yet interpreting it in so many different ways.
And would be a very good argument as to why people faction and splinter from those religions, because at a grassroots level, they disagree with a teaching, maybe because of a direct influence on a topic, and therefore either defect or abandon that religion altogether.
Yes. If you looked at other issues that are treated in the same verses of the Bible that deal with homosexuality, if you gave them the same weight and the same type of interpretation, religion would look a lot different now, and we would be stoning people to death for fairly minor infractions, and we would be telling women to stay silent in church. Too many of us do that anyway, unfortunately.
We would be blessing our refreshments from our closets only.
Yeah. Yeah. So we all play the same game, but it's a game that is never beneficial in the long run. If you really want to discern God's will, you have to be willing to engage the scriptures in their full context and realize that they represent the current, meaning the generation that produced those scriptures, their best effort at interpreting the Word of God. But there's a difference between the Word of God and the words of God. The Word of God among biblical scholars means this is the inspiration that we perceive and we are doing our best to put it into words. But it's an imperfect process because it comes through imperfect humans. The words of God is the model that says God dictates, the scribe takes it down word for word, it's inerrant, and off we go. That isn't supported by the reality of what the scriptures are.
Let's shift a little bit and talk about how we use scripture, modern day revelation, personal revelation, in terms of how members influence this topic and are influenced by this topic.
All right.
What can we do, or is there a process already in place that is allowing the general membership to see this topic in a different light and make positive contributions to the LGBT community?
It's not coming from the top. It comes from interactions with gay people and with families and with this gradual realization that, hey, these are great people. They want to be part of the community. They're adding to it. Once you get to that point, then you automatically start to rethink the biases that put you in the wrong place to begin with. So it's trickle up, not trickle down.
You believe the personal testimonies of the grassroots members eventually influence the top?
They can, if the top are listening.
And that was my lead-in question. Because the top pays attention to the grassroots, or there is a larger consensus, a larger contingency of members who are now becoming favorable? You talk a lot about research in your book in terms of numbers and statistical probabilities based on voting averages or how laws are passed or propositions were approved or disapproved. Do you think that same principle exists within Mormonism, where the leadership of the church looks down and says, we are having a larger than normal or greater than average number of members who have favorable feelings about LGBT topics?
There is some polling of the membership. The church for a long time has had a division, a department, a collection of social scientists who are very good at doing surveys and taking the pulse. Most of the results of those surveys will never be publicly disclosed, either because the very nature of them tends to be confidential or because the numbers may not go the direction the president thought they would go. Occasionally, you'll hear some of the better results when they make everybody feel good, but you don't hear the other results very often. So that would be one factor. Another factor would be who's got the ear of somebody who sits in a red chair. Now, that's disproportionate. We don't all have the same value in our vote on that level. If we are related to a general authority, if we are a neighbor of a general authority, if we have a business relationship with the general authority, our voice is going to have more weight than the voice of the Mormon in the trenches. That's just the reality of it. Also, in the case of LGBT issues, who has it in his own family? More and more, as society in general and Mormon society specifically become more welcoming of LGBTQ people, then there is a greater impetus for closeted people to come out. There's not an epidemic. It's that more people now feel comfortable coming out than did a generation ago. But that's disproportionate geographically. If you're on the two coasts, you're in a much more gay-friendly atmosphere than if you're in the red states in the middle.
Not that New York and the northeastern side of the United States or California in the West have more gays.
Well, they do, but it's because of migration.
There you go. Yeah.
Because it's a gay-friendly atmosphere. So New York and San Francisco and Seattle and L.A. and even D.C. Are viewed as much more gay-friendly than certainly the interior cities are.
But not that liberal progressive communities are creating biologically more naturally born gay children.
If anything, the Mormons are creating more naturally born gay children because Mormon men have been advised by bishops for a long time just to get married and the gay will go away. Given that there's a genetic component to this, that sets the stage for a disproportionate number of gay babies being born in the Mormon church.
Factor number two, large numbers of children.
Sure. Then you get the birth order effect compounding that. Yep. Can't put numbers on that, but you can see the general trend and the rationale behind it.
Makes perfect sense. So as I like that you brought up the surveys, because often I believe that the New World Translation for the word revelation is survey within Mormonism. So much of the church's change results from a survey or a poll that has been released through those methods that you talked about, because we see them in stakes and wards and emails. How do you feel about this topic? What is your general feeling regarding this? And I see that as the church's way of polling its members.
Yes. Within the Mormon tradition, I think that there are synonyms for revelation that can include information and perspiration and relation. That's all part of the same process.
In terms of, let's talk process and membership and hemorrhaging and difficult positions the church finds itself in, and take a deep dive into November 2015.
Okay.
For those who are unaware, November 2015, the church releases a policy excluding the children of same-sex couples from blessing, baptism, and ordinances. They add some caveats to that or some additional restrictions that at the age of 18, once the child disavows the same-sex relationship of their parent, they, and then after beta version one, after approval of a first member of the first presidency, then that person could join the church via baptism. How problematic was that for the church?
Well, you left out one part, and that is that the gay couple is declared automatically in apostasy. Oh, that.
It seems so minor.
Yeah. A couple weeks after that was announced, I got a call from the president of Wesley Seminary asking if I could go to lunch, And the main topic he wanted to discuss was, I thought I knew a little bit about Mormon theology. What have I missed that allows Mormons to beat up on infants?
It seems as though the November 2015 policy comes out, and we also delete the first article of faith at the same time.
I think it's the second.
The second? That we're not to be punished for the sins of Adam's transgression?
Yes.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, second repentance. That's right.
No, that's the fourth one. The first one is we believe in God, the eternal Father.
See, I've become so disconnected with my articles of faith.
Oh, it's one of them. Yes.
Second article of faith.
Yeah.
We're going to punish children for the actions of their parents.
That's right. Innocent children.
Innocent infants. Children.
Not just punishing them, but in a way, it's an act of spiritual violence, because the blessing of children, christening and other religious traditions, is really the rite of passage that announces to the religious community not only the birth of this child, but the acceptance of that child into the community. And by denying that child the blessing, you are in essence saying to the parents, we do not acknowledge the existence of this child. That's pretty brutal.
Which is also counterproductive to the message of the church.
You would think.
Which is the focus of families.
Yes. Yes. From the outset, this was a flawed policy. There were people in the hierarchy who almost from day one were complaining about it. It had not gone through the usual vetting process. It was dropped onto the 12 rather abruptly and without discussion. They were asked to vote on it. Well, in their ethic, once it's presented as the will of the president and the will of the Lord, there's only one way to vote, and that's what happened. But from day one, it was a problematic policy. It was very destructive. It resulted in uncounted departures from the church. One source said that there were over 60,000 formal resigned memberships in the year after the policy was announced. Multiply that by whatever coefficient you want. I don't know what it is, but a lot more people will just walk away than will take the time to formally apply for removing their membership records.
You call it a flawed policy. Nelson called it a revelation in Hawaii.
I did.
Does that paint the church into a corner?
That's what some of the people at the level of 70s that I talked to said. They were in a quandary thinking, how are we going to get out of this corner? One of them said, it's going to take us 15 years. It wound up taking 3. And I don't know yet what the process was of backing out of that corner, but they managed to do it. I'm grateful that they did, but it doesn't get us back to where we were before the policy began.
So April 4th, 2019, the church announces that they are rescinding the November 2015 policy.
Yep.
And ironically, this was done by Elder Oaks, mm-hmm. who is the voice. Any correlation?
Don't know.
Anything that says in Greg's brain that was planned?
I don't know.
I'm asking you to speculate a little.
I am a scientist. I don't go beyond where the data allow me to go.
I'll say hypothecate.
I don't know. If we're patient, then bits and pieces gradually tend to trickle out. And a story will emerge. It may not be the entire story, but it will be the rough outline of it. There has to have been some awareness of the hemorrhage that policy caused. Whether that was the decisive thing in their decision to reverse it, I don't know. But nobody who was paying attention failed to see the hemorrhage, and it was particularly severe amongst the lower age demographics. For the millennials, for Generation Z, it was a devastating effect, and it continues to be. We're seeing the pews thin out of that demographic. And if we lose them, we don't get them back.
Not this generation or the next, or possibly the next.
Speculation, but it wouldn't be hard to see if we had left that policy intact. Will we reverse that trend now? Will we stop the hemorrhage? I don't know. Because the younger demographics tend to base their decisions on actions and not words.
This was explained to me the other day as I was speaking with an LGBT person, very active in the church, still trying to hold both worlds together, both his sexuality and his religion. And he made a comment that was very interesting about how he is working to try to put, he likened this to a vase, a clear glass vase that was shattered. He's now glued it back together. The pieces still exist. It's opaque. There are problems with the vase, and he doesn't know how to reconcile that.
My analogy is you're stepping in something in the middle of the road, and then you step back out of it, but you're not where you were before you stepped in. You got stuff on your shoes that's hard to get off.
And unanswered questions.
Certainly.
So often, interesting that believing members of the church say this is beautiful revelation, exciting to see what happened with the change, but yet we still have so many unanswered questions as, two questions. What is the true status of a same-sex married couple in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints today? What is the status of the people who were excommunicated because of apostasy, who now no longer are guilty of apostasy? It goes back to those who are excommunicated from the church for bringing up topics that are now discussed in the gospel topic essays that are very open on the church's website.
The ripple effect of this was far excessive to the immediate effect of it, meaning we had over 60,000 members in the first year who resigned their membership, and many more than that who just walked away. The number of gays who were disciplined because of this policy would have been minuscule by comparison. I don't think that they factored that into their thinking initially. And at some point, they had to realize that floodgates had inadvertently been opened, and to leave them opened was approaching institutional suicide.
Very good point. I asked this direct question to a 70 in terms of how this could impact number-wise, and he brought up a great point. He said, really, when you factor in the number of children who are affected by the November 2015 policy, you're talking about not thousands and maybe not even high hundreds. When you consider the total number of children that are impacted by a same-sex relationship who are either recently born into the church or are under 8 years of age, he said it's nominal.
Yeah.
Which led me to believe then why the November 2015 policy.
Sure. And why would a gay couple try to raise their child in the church with the intent of having that child turn away from the church? It makes no sense. That child to be raised in the church because that's their own tribe, and they know that it's a benevolent tribe, and they want the very best for their kid. And that's what was stripped from them with that policy.
Unfortunately, your book came out prior to April 4th, so we don't get to dissect this revision policy, but maybe there will be an amendment.
We'll see what kind of tidbits of data flow out. I don't know.
To me, it's fascinating. The sky is the limit. This might be the telling opportunity to start understanding the repercussion of the November 2015 policy.
Well, it goes to the subtitle of the book, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. And the law of unintended consequences, in my view, is just starting to act with reference to the policy and to the reversal of the policy. We don't know yet what the unintended consequences are going to be, but they will be there.
But at least one consequence was mass exodus.
Yes. And when people leave, either for that or for the garden variety faith crisis issues, you don't get them back.
Where do they go? Which has got to be a question.
Generally, they don't go to institutional religion, primarily because of the dichotomy that they've been raised with. Either this church is, whatever you want to characterize that, or it's the biggest fraud that's ever been perpetrated on men. You've heard that kind
Gordon
of rhetoric
Hinckley.
There. And so if they're raised with that dichotomy, if they see or sense that this isn't working for them, we've left them no place to go. And so their tendency is just to abandon institutional religion.
And it doesn't take 15 or 16 major events. In my experience, it's 1, 2, or 3 opportunities to look at a doctrine or a policy, and they say,
that's 2 tends enough. To be the magic number. I was working with the survey from 2011 that really put flesh on the bones of faith crisis. John DeLynn was involved in it. Travis Stratford in New York was involved in it. And even though we were able to rank what are the questions that are tipping people over, the underlying theme was, my first question was the gateway. If I found, for instance, that Joseph Smith had multiple lives, that was disruptive to me. But then I moved to other questions, and I saw the pattern. When they discerned that the pattern was, my church has been withholding information from me, they don't trust me, so I will no longer trust them. That's what tended to take them out. It wasn't a single issue. It was the underlying issue of trust. And once you abandon trust in your church, if that church has said there's nowhere else to go, then you don't go anywhere else. You just leave religion.
The atheist who died all dressed up and no place to go.
Yeah.
In your book, you focus a lot about gay rights, but you also have a section in the book regarding the trans topic.
Yep.
Why was that important to you to include in a book that focuses on the consequences?
Because it's the T of LGBTQ. Initially, it was a very small part of a very small chapter that also included intersex. And as I sat on that for a few months, I thought, this is not doing justice to it. It was a small chapter because there's almost nothing on the church record for either trans or intersex. And so I had to deal mostly with the stories of church members who either are trans or in some instances have been married to trans and get their stories. That allowed me at least to flesh out what I think is a coherent chapter. You had a trans woman say from the podium, you got that exactly right in that chapter. So that pleases me because I wasn't sure that I was getting it right. Medically, scientifically, we know almost nothing yet about trans. We know more about sexual orientation, but gender identity is still mostly a blank slate.
And very harsh in terms of restriction and punishment within Mormonism.
And I think more prone to engender natural aversion.
Because it's not understood?
Because in the case of the LGB, you're talking about people who are what they are. In the case of T, you're talking about people who appeared to be one thing and are now transforming that into something that has a very different appearance. And that's a more difficult thing for people to wrap their minds around, particularly if it involves surgery or even medical treatment, chemical treatment. For me, that's a more difficult concept to wrap my mind around as well. And yet, it's a reality. And these people are no less worthy of full humanness than we are. But I can see that that's a much more difficult reach for people than just to accept you because you happen to be gay.
The very interesting part, and I'll leave this as a teaser for those who really need to read your book, especially with the trans topic. Yes or no, trans member of the church married in the temple?
Happened when I was in the room, performed by a general authority, with full disclosure.
That exists in your book?
Yes.
It was a fascinating read.
Yeah. That may be a unique event in the whole history of the church. I don't know. I was there because I was the elders' quorum president of the groom.
And intersex. We have temple ordinances performed for members of the church who were, on the outside, appeared to be men. Genetically, they were 100% female.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with that? I don't know.
So is this an appearance-based priesthood?
I don't even know how to answer that one. What do you do under those circumstances? In my mind, you do what's right, whatever that turns out to be. We don't understand intersex as much as we understand trans, and we don't understand trans as much as we understand gay.
You ready for a few Q&As?
Sure.
So we obviously there were a few people interested in this interview, so I reached out to ask a handful of questions. The one question that I had was concerning the rescission policy. This question came from someone who is the father of a gay daughter, lesbian daughter, who his name would be very familiar among many people in the church, and they're in a position where they're not sure where their membership level should remain based upon sexuality topic alone.
Okay.
He asks, you mentioned during your speeches that the internal pressure for change was people voting with their feet and leaving the church. Do you think the reversal of the November policy changes that trend?
No.
Or is this just one systematic problem with an authoritarian church?
I don't think that it will stop the hemorrhage. I think it may slow the hemorrhage. But the old trite example of the feathers in a pillow, once you release those, how do you gather all of them up again? You don't. You get some of them. And so the damage that was done by that policy is lasting. And just reversing the policy doesn't make everything nice and sweet again.
Back to that opaque glass because of all the cracks.
Yeah. It's better than perpetuating the policy, but it doesn't fix where we were before the policy.
You can't start a fire, burn down the forest, and look around and say, because the fire's out, everything's better.
Yeah.
We've lost the trees. We've lost the vegetation. We've lost generations of growth.
Yeah.
Second question. Maya Angelou said, when you know better, you do better. Reading the events that occurred at BYU regarding conversion therapy and then jumping forward to BYU's issues with the honor code and all that attention, has the church learned and implemented better, or is this just business as usual?
Well, at least they've gotten away from the draconian reparative therapy that they were doing at BYU.
Electric shock therapy?
Electric shock therapy, vomiting therapy. They were not the only ones doing that at the time, but that's not a justification for doing it. The damage was done. I keep hearing reports that some of the people who were involved in McBride's study there at BYU committed suicide. I've never been able to document that, so I don't know. But certainly it did horrendous damage, because I've talked to some of the people who were involved in those studies, and they said it made a mess out of me, and I've never recovered.
You have sections of your book that discuss those.
Yes.
And they're painful.
They're very painful. And yet I think that there are still people who are convinced that conversion therapy, which is just a kinder term for the same thing, can still work. I don't see a shred of evidence to support that. But I think it just reflects that people are hanging on to that behavioral paradigm, that this is just a bad choice, and so we can help you to choose for the better. And the way to do that is conversion therapy. They're not doing the electrical shock anymore, and they're not doing the emetic therapy, vomiting, but it's a fool's errand that they're on, because it won't work. It won't fix the situation in their minds. What it will do is lasting damage. This is why the American Psychological Association in 2009, in a major report on conversion therapy, said, we can conclude two things. Number one, there is not convincing evidence that this works, period. And number two, there is convincing evidence that in many cases it causes lasting damage.
As of the publication of this podcast, there are 15 states who have banned conversion therapy. Reparative therapy is declining. But I also believe that there's another form of conversion therapy, especially within Mormonism, that exists, and that's at a bishop's interview, or ways that some bishops are handling the topic of homosexuality in terms of pray more, attend the temple more.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book that's called The Cure 1.0. That was the first attempt by church leaders to address this. It didn't work, and so they went to the Cure 2.0, which was the active intervention. That didn't work either, but it appears that some of these people have gone back to 1.0 to try again. It won't be any more successful the second time than it was the first time.
What motivation does the church have in opening the plan of salvation to LGBT people?
Justice. It's going to be a difficult transition for some of them to make. Maybe they can't make it. I think a lot of it reflects, if you will, a reverse engineering of a future state that we don't understand anyway. That if you believe in an afterlife that doesn't have gay, then reverse engineering that, there's no legitimacy to gay in this life. And if you acknowledge the biological imprint, then you've created a conundrum that you can't get out of. So I think this is why some people in the church, maybe even some of the people who sit in the red chairs, keep crossing their fingers when you talk about biology, because biology negates their view of what the afterlife is going to be. In my mind, I don't need to know much about the afterlife. We don't know much about it. We don't have a clue, really. And so let's focus on people in this life and help everybody and harm nobody. That's good theology.
It's great sociology as well.
Yes.
Do you think the church has done litigating LGBT issues in government? And why did they not involve themselves in governments outside of the United States in terms of LGBT topics?
They did a bit in Argentina when marriage equality was on the ballot down there. It wasn't a full-throated effort as they had done here with Prop 8. I think they realize that this is a losing hand now, that the pendulum has swung all the way to that extreme, at least in the United States, and that other countries gradually will go in the same direction. So why expend your resources and why suffer the consequences of trying to stop what's inevitable?
One of the church's great arguments against homosexuality or same-sex marriage in particular was that it threatened heterosexual marriages.
Doesn't threaten mine.
Does that, because that is the truth, now that for multiple years we've had homosexual marriages?
Well, in the United States, you can really go back to 2004. Not nationally, but on a state-by-state
Massachusetts.
Basis. Massachusetts. Yeah. And society hasn't appeared to crumble because of that. It's crumbling for other reasons, but you can't put that one on the backs of the gays.
So does that threaten the legitimacy of statements like Oakes, who crafted that logic that a gay marriage would threaten that of a heterosexual marriage?
I think all of the data argue against his premise. Show me the data that there is a threat there, and then we'll talk.
Didn't convince the Supreme Court for some reason.
No. No, because that nor has the reality of the aftermath gone in that direction. If anything, I think straight couples could learn some lessons from gay couples. And in terms of parenting abilities, I think that a gay couple is probably more likely to have a successful outcome than a straight couple. If for no other reason, then there's really no such thing as an accidental pregnancy in a gay relationship. So you don't have unwanted children.
Great response. Last question. What involvement did the church take in contributing to your book?
None. I reached out to them early on through public affairs, requested access to certain men, primarily who were involved in Proposition 8, some of them at the general level, some in California. But I explained exactly what I was doing in writing. I outlined the scope of the book. I even listed the interviews that I had already done and asked that they be a voice at the table. It took them 4 months to respond, and the response, which is in the introduction to the book, is one sentence that basically says, "We have elected not to cooperate in this." That's unfortunate because there are really two voices missing in there. Theirs is one. The other that I tried to get and just couldn't find was the fiercely pro-Proposition 8 voice that was still fiercely pro-Proposition 8. There was a lot of buyer's remorse out there, And those people came forward and talked. But I couldn't find the people who were giving full-throated support in 2008 and who still are willing to go on the record saying, yeah, that was a really good deal. So that voice and the institutional church voice are not there, but it was not for lack of trying. They were invited to the table and they elected not to come.
What does that tell your scientific brain?
Well, generally, they have not been responsive to that kind of invitation for other books as well. It didn't surprise me, but I was trying to be fair and to cover the bases. And I would have welcomed them being at the table. I think it would have been a better book if it had reflected their sincere input as to the way they view the world. But you have to imply it on the basis of their writings, of their speeches, of what other people who know them are saying on the record. But that's imperfect. It would have been much better to have them at the table directly.
Fascinating book, fascinating podcast interview.
Thank you.
Any last words? Anything that we should have covered?
Oh, this is an ongoing saga, so there's not going to be a last word.
I like it. So just like CURP 1.0 and 2.0, we may have a follow-up?
If we don't have a follow-up book within the next few years, somebody's not paying attention.
We already
I'm not going to be the one to write it. I got other things to do now.
We already have chapter number one, which is April 4th, 2019.
Except we don't have source material yet.
Interesting. And I was going to bring that up, that interesting that it was just a press release. We have no video. We have no context, no background as to why or who the players were involved in that.
Eventually, these things come out.
I'm very anxious to see how that unfolds. And I agree. I think it is a follow-up, an amendment to this very topic. For people who are interested in purchasing your book, where do we find it?
Best place is Amazon because they give a pretty good discount.
And two-day shipping.
Sometimes one-day shipping if you're Amazon Prime.
There you go. Do you have a Kindle version?
Yes.
An online version as well?
There is, and it's also available through Amazon.
Gay Rights in the Mormon Church?
Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences.
Author Gregory Prince.
Yep.
Thank you again for your time.
My pleasure.
Really been a very fascinating discussion, and excited to have a few minutes to sit down and talk with you.
We'll do it again.
Let's do it. The Latter-day Stories podcast is your opportunity to understand the intersection of sexuality and reality. Again, grateful for the time that Greg gave us. If you have a question directly for Greg and you're watching on our video version of this podcast, we invite you to make a comment below on our Facebook page or YouTube channel, and we'll get that filtered directly over to Greg. But most importantly, I think this is a great opportunity for the listening audience to create a dialogue discussion regarding this topic. As we discussed earlier in the podcast, a lot of the information surrounding this topic begins at a grassroots level. And you are the grassroots. You are the LGBTQ advocates. You are the parents, the brothers, the sons, the daughters of people who identify along this spectrum. You are the ones who, as we discussed earlier, are the ones who create the greatest amount of change from a trickle-up basis. And it's through venues and forums just like this that we're able to do that. So if you are watching on our Facebook page, we invite you to follow along in a conversation below, and let's discuss it. If you're watching on our YouTube channel as well, we invite you over to our Facebook page. And through the audio versions like Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcast, and others, we invite you to rate this podcast wherever you listen and give us a share as well. We are really interested in hearing what you have to say on the podcast side. The Latter-day Stories podcast, your opportunity to understand the intersection of LGBTQ Avenue and LDS Street. But most importantly, this podcast episode gives you the opportunity to continue writing your Latter-day story.
This episode is a production of Latter-day Stories. We are always looking for new friends. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Latter-day Stories. The podcast is made possible because of generous donors like you. Make a donation now by texting the word STORIES to 77948. Your donation gives us the ability to build bigger bridges by producing more Latter-day Stories. Want more? Find this episode and others online at LatterGayStories.org.